Hello everybody, welcome back to the StatDose podcast. It's Matt and Joe again, doing another Turbo Dose. Today we're doing acute coronary syndromes. Fans of the podcast will realise that we've already done this in the Stat Medical Topics. It's a much longer episode, though it's about 40 minutes long. So if you've got the time and or interest, or if you're really, really bored, then that'd be good for you to listen to. But otherwise, this is going to be a briefer episode, just covering the key pathophysiology, key presentation and investigations, and looking at some management.
So as always, we're going to start with an overview of acute coronary syndromes. And acute coronary syndrome, as we know, is an umbrella term, and it encompasses several conditions. But the key crux of it is that all of these conditions relate to myocardial ischemia. So traditionally, we think of ACS as including unstable angina, NSTEMI, and STEMI. So NSTEMI obviously being non-ST elevation, MI, and STEMI being ST elevation, MI. Now, the usual process for this is that you have an atherosclerotic plaque and this ruptures, leading to clot formation. And this is either platelet-rich clot, so otherwise known as a white clot, or a platelet and fibrin-rich clot, which is known as a red clot. And red clots cause that complete obstruction of the coronary vessel and leads to continual ischemia, whereas a white clot causes more often partial obstruction with intermittent ischemia. In essence, red clots cause STEMI, white clots cause NSTEMI and unstable angina. Risk factors for acute coronary syndrome are the same as those for atherosclerosis. So, male predominance, increasing age, those who smoke, diabetic patients, high blood pressure, hyperlipidemia, and previous or known coronary artery disease.
In terms of potential presentations, we often talk about cardiac-sounding chest pain. So that is typically sort of a pressure-type sensation, can be heavy, can be crushing. Patients often describe something like an elephant sat on their chest or a vice being constricted, which I think are quite sort of graphic pictures to have in your mind. Generally central or left-sided, sort of retrosternal-type pain. It can radiate to both arms, sometimes more the left than the right. Can radiate to the neck, can radiate to the jaw as well. And it's generally unrelated to breathing or movement. Now, the issue with acute coronary syndromes is that they often present slightly atypically. So lots of patients who end up having acute coronary syndromes don't present with that central crushing chest pain. They don't come in clutching their chest. And equally, the pain might be a little bit atypical as well. So it might be more right-sided. It might not radiate anywhere. It might radiate to the right arm. So just be a bit cautious when you're seeing patients with chest pain. And other cardinal features might include shortness of breath, which might be acute onset. Sweating, always fear the sweating patient. Nausea and vomiting, again, quite common. These sort of atypical features are particularly more common in women, diabetics, because you get a degree of neuropathy, and patients from an Afro-Caribbean background. In terms of examination, moving on to that, so when you examine patients, you're not trying to examine for acute coronary syndrome, you're not looking for any specific features. You're looking for non-specific findings, such as tachycardia, they might be pale, they might be sweaty. But the key really is getting an ECG early. And what features are we particularly interested in, Joe?
Thanks, Matt. I think actually throwing that question at me so suddenly is giving me a spot chest pain, actually. So there are multiple findings on an ECG that can allude to myocardial ischemia. The predominant issue that we're going to be looking for on an ECG is, of course, ST elevation, and then trying to map that to a specific area with reciprocal ST depression. Myocardial ischemia can also present with T-wave inversion and ST depression, or just T-wave inversion by itself. You want to look for pathological Q waves, particularly in the context of significant ST elevation. Mm-hmm. However, pathological Q waves can be something that's fixed from previous myocardial damage. And a new onset of left bundle branch block with chest pain should always be presumed to be a myocardial infarction until proven otherwise. What's really helpful to undertake here is serial ECGs, because this is an evolving condition and an ECG is only a snapshot in time. And really, really important to just go back through the system and look at previous ECGs, particularly not so much in the context of fixed ST elevation, although you can get that. But a lot of people have looked snippets of ST depression or Q waves or T wave inversion that can be really, really common, and it's just a normal finding for them. And then, of course, the classic left bundle branch block picture. You know, does that patient have left bundle already, or is this definitely a new left bundle branch block? Because left bundle is super, super common. So that's what you want to look for in an ECG. However, the absence of signs of acute coronary syndrome on an ECG doesn't necessarily mean that there is no myocardial damage occurring, and you need to therefore corroborate the examination findings and the ECG alongside blood tests. And if you're really high, you've got a high index of suspicion for ACS, you need to not be put off by a normal ECG, look for some bloods and move on from there. And so what bloods would you be looking for, Matt?
Obviously, we're going to start, you know, we check an FBC. Anemia is quite important. Anemia can sort of drive a type 2 MI due to the poor myocardial oxygen supply. Coagulation is always helpful for baseline, just to make sure there's nothing abnormal going on there. Biochemistry-wise, you want your routine using these LFTs, CRP. But the troponin is key to, as you say, to identifying myocardial ischemia. It's released in response to ischemia from damaged myocytes. Now, the issue with troponin is very sensitive. So we're using what's been termed the newly sensitive troponins. They've been newly sensitive for about 5 years, so I don't know what...
They don't like you talking about, and they're very sensitive.
Not that. No, not sensitive like you, Joe.
Okay.
I think the slight frustration from a lot of clinicians is that they're raised in lots of other conditions. So they're raised in anything that could potentially cause a myocardial injury, be that sort of, you know, pericarditis, myocarditis, cardiomyopathies, where you've got dilated heart, and, you know, anything that's going to cause dilation or a bit of ischemia to the myocardium, irrespective of whether it's an ACS or not, can cause a raised troponin. Troponin is cleared by the kidneys, so if you've got CKD or some sort of renal failure, you're likely to have a higher troponin as well. So most patients, you know, a single troponin isn't helpful for probably the majority of our patients, actually. If we're worried enough about an acute coronary syndrome to take a troponin, a single troponin is often unhelpful. So actually the trend is more helpful. So you want to take a second troponin several hours after you've taken the first troponin. Now, there's lots of different, you know, guidelines and rules, and check that with your local hospital.
From a management perspective, clearly the key management objectives for an acute coronary syndrome is to reduce myocardial oxygen demand and increase coronary blood flow. So we need to adopt an ABCDE approach, shock horror, looking for significant complications of acute coronary syndrome. So we want to target those oxygen saturations between 94 and 98%, but these patients do not need high flow oxygen.
No.
We've had plenty of evidence now to suggest that broad and non-judicious use of oxygen in MI patients is actually associated with worse outcomes. So we don't smack high flow oxygen on them inevitably. We just target the saturations, unless, of course, COPD or chronic type 2 respiratory failure patients, so 88 to 92. And we want to monitor blood pressure and start some effective management strategies. So we want to start some analgesia, preferably with opiates. Aspirin is a really crucial part of the treatment algorithm. It's an antiplatelet agent. It's given as a loading dose of 300 milligrams and then 75 milligrams once a day, indefinitely afterwards. The individual has already taken their 75 milligrams. You would still give them a loading dose of 300 in an acute situation. So that's something that often individuals get confused with, but actually irrelevant. They need an additional loading dose. And then we want to get a second antiplatelet on board. Now, this is really dependent on local guidelines and what your cardiology colleagues wish for, but can be either clopidogrel.
You said that deliberately.
Clopidogrel. I was going to try and do the other ones funnily, but I can't. Prasugrel. It can be clopidogrel, prasugrel, or ticagrelor, based on your local guidelines. So that kind of dual antiplatelet action is what we're wanting to establish. And then nitrates clearly being the last thing that we need to look for. So nitrates are often given initially sublingually, so via a GTN spray, but the individual may require IV infusions if there's ongoing ischemia. Where do we escalate these patients to from there? Where do they go? What's the kind of definitive management?
So we want to get our cardiology colleagues involved, as you mentioned, and really the key, so if you've got a STEMI, the key is to get them to primary PCI. We can still thrombolize patients. That does occur in some remote areas. Outside of STEMIs, angiography is still helpful for the NSTEMI patients and often the unstable angina patients. There are lots of risk stratifying scores. GRACE is the one that comes to mind. They will help identify which patients are likely to benefit from angiography. And angiography for these patients is both diagnostic and therapeutic. So if you insert some stents, you increase obviously coronary blood flow to the impacted areas. And the only other really sort of final interventional management to mention is the use of coronary artery bypass grafting, or CABG as it's abbreviated to. Now, often if you've got more than one vessel affected, either, you know, double vessel or triple vessel disease, then bypass grafting is often more helpful than placing stents. So a lot of plaques aren't amenable to PCI. And if you've got multiple vessels implicated, cabbages is often more beneficial for those patients.
Yeah, and they can also be a really good condiment to a roast. So that's just a quick run through of the overview and pathophysiology surrounding acute coronary syndrome. We've talked about the presentation and the investigations. We've talked about a bit of management, which really surrounds your aspirin, your morphine, your oxygenation, if necessary, and nitrates, with a preference to move on to PCI and sort of referral to acute cardiology as soon as possible. Early escalation is absolutely key in order to save as much myocardium. So hopefully this has been beneficial for you, and we will see you next time.